Today's episode is presented by A24's Undertone in theaters this Friday the 13th. This is the scariest movie you'll ever hear. It follows the host of a popular paranormal podcast who becomes haunted by terrifying recordings mysteriously sent her way. Now, don't take this as your cue to start sending me creepy recordings, by the way. I am a very delicate podcast host, and the last thing I need is for this horror movie stuff to leak into my reality. Let that stay on the big screen, please and thank you. Undertone is the feature debut of writer-director Ian Towson and has left critics raving. Hear for yourself and experience Undertone in theaters this Friday the 13th. Get your tickets now. And Fangoria has been at it for over 40 years, and it is better than ever. This magazine, it's not only gorgeous, it's highly collectible and delivered right to your door 4 times a year. Each issue filled to the brim with articles exploring every nook and cranny of genre filmmaking, past, present, and future, with all the most exciting journalists, filmmakers, and horror know-it-alls to guide the way, including little old me from time to time. This high-quality writing will only ever appear within the physical pages of the magazine, so if you want to join in on the fun, you're going to need to subscribe. And in order to do that, all you got to do is head on over to Fangoria.com and sign up. And since KingCast listeners are in the family, if you use the code KingCast at checkout, you will save 25% off of your subscription. That is Fangoria.com, code KingCast. Now on with the show.
Hi, my name is Stephen King.
The ice is gonna break!
Bedroom!
You guys wanna go see a dead body?
Well, sometimes, dead is better.
Hello and welcome back to the KingCast on the Fangoria Podcast Network. I'm Eric Vespi.
I'm Anthony Bresnikan.
And we are your hosts. Our guest today is quickly becoming a favorite returner, and he's back this time to talk about short stories, specifically the shorts from Stephen King's Nightmares and Dreamscapes. Why, you may ask? Well, he's got his own short story collection that you can currently pre-order that sees release May 5th. It's called I Know a Place, and not only is it chock full of great genre fare from masked killers wielding creepy crawlies to evil elves, it also comes with one hell of an introduction from our show's namesake. Get your pre-orders in now, kiddies. You're not going to want to miss this one. You know him from his previous appearances on the show, as well as Nestlings, Mary, and last year's When the Wolf Comes Home. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome Nat Cassidy back to the show.
Welcome, Nat.
Hello. Oh, thank you. The applause. Thank you. Oh,
a little applause. I'm doing a new thing. I'm trying to...
It's going to be like Drive Time Radio soon. We'll have some sound effects.
Woo!
Toilet flushing, you know, all that.
Eric and the Brez.
It's going to be like John Candy and Little Shop of Horrors by the end of the year. Or my name isn't Eric Vespi.
Weird.
Get a slide whistle.
Yep. For sure. Well, welcome back, man. This is very exciting. It's so funny. We've gotten to the point now where you've come on the show a couple of times, and still, when there's a publicist email that came in going, "Hey, I don't know if you know this, but Stephen King is writing an intro for this up and coming horror author," just like, "Oh."
And that guy.
It was very funny. The email came in, and I said, "Oh, cool." And I went and opened up another email to you going, "Hey, do you want to come back on the show?" And of course, you know, the publicist was very nice and helped facilitate stuff. But it is interesting that we're at that spot now where it's just like, hey, you know, you got a new thing coming out. It's time for the new Nat episode.
I got no complaints. It is always such a pleasure to chat with you guys. So thank you for having me on to chat about this one. It's definitely happier circumstances than our last episode. That's for damn sure.
The
what
Rob
was happening
Reiner.
Then? I forget.
We did we brought Nat back on for the Rob Reiner memorial.
Oh, that one. Yeah. Oh, I was thinking of the earlier one, When the Wolf Comes Home. That was the...
Well, that was a morning episode, too. It's just like, oh, man, this story. Damn this book.
God damn it.
This wolf. Why did it have to come home?
Why did it have to be wolves?
But yeah, I kind of buried the lead a little bit, but I did talk about, you know, that you have Stephen King actually doing the intro for your book, and it's a great intro too. Like, I don't want to spoil too much, you know, the book isn't out for another month or so, a couple of months now. And here's the thing is I don't want to get into too many specifics, but when I read it, I was just like, I could almost put myself into your shoes, like seeing that going, like, just, it must have been an out-of-body experience, because like one of his opening lines is like, "This is fucking great," right? Like, yeah. Just your writing, fucking great. And you have Stephen King telling you that? It's like, I can't imagine. Then he goes at length about why it's great. But so can you tell me a little bit about that process and how King did it and what your reaction was when you actually read what his intro was?
He says but Nat, before you get started, he says you emailed him and mentioned John D. McDonald's intro to Night Shift.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, McDonald was a hero of Steve's. And did before you talk about how you got his approval, can you tell us a little about McDonald's intro for Night Shift and why that struck a nerve with you?
Yeah, I mean, honestly, it was, you know, I read these collections all the time. I'm usually like pulling them off the shelves and just reading like a story here and there, or just kind of flipping through them, because I am a visual inspirer. I don't know how to phrase that. I get inspiration visually sometimes. So just like literally looking at the stories and like looking at the table of contents and being like, oh, that the vibe that story gave me. Like, I want to do the last rung on the ladder vibes for this chapter or something like that. Right. So I'll often pull these collections out. They all mean a great deal to me. And we had, we already like knew that this collection was going to be coming out because there's a little table setting for the collection itself. It's with the publisher. It's with the publishing company Shortwave. And they had previously published this novella, Rest Stop. But since then, they have this great distribution deal that is new with Simon & Schuster. And we're like, well, with this distribution deal, let's reissue Rest Stop so it can actually like be available in stores and stuff like that. And so we're like, well, we don't want to just like make people buy it again. Let's actually like put it together in a collection. And as King fans, we know there's nothing better than like a novella and then a bunch of short stories after it. I was thinking of the Skeleton Crew kind of mode. But since this would be my first collection, I was like, I kind of want to revisit Night Shift for the 1,000th time. And I pulled that off the shelf and immediately I was like, oh yeah, I kind of forgot there was this John D. McDonald intro. And, you know, John D. McDonald is a writer that he has long, been vocal about his admiration for, and how he's just like one of the best, if not the best mystery writers of all time. And, you know, he's the great Travis McGee series
he told us he was going to write the final Travis McGee thing after McDonald died.
Oh, that's right. That's right. Cool. Yeah. The KingCast exclusive. yeah, he better get on that.
Well, his son, McDonald's son, told him not to. So he was like, all right.
Oh, no shit. Oh, I didn't realize that. Another exclusive. So I was just kind of, you know, rolling that over in my head, thinking, you know, I do want an introduction for this collection. And the timing was such that he had already said really, really nice things about my story in the Stand anthology and about When the Wolf Comes Home. And I have been in contact with his assistant for, you know, years at this point, basically being like, do you think you would like to read my book? Can I mail you guys another copy of my book? So I wrote her an email that was, I think, literally opening with, this is probably the dumbest suggestion you're going to get today, the dumbest proposal you're going to get today. But I was looking at Night Shift and I reread the John D. McDonald intro, and I know that must have meant a great deal to him, especially that point in his career. Do you think there's any chance he'd have like the schedule or interest to write an intro for my first short story collection that is coming out soon? Absolutely understand if the answer is no, or even if there is no answer, but, you know, just throwing it out there. And I didn't hear anything for like a week or two, and was just like, yeah, all right, I shot the shot. Mm-hmm. Then he wrote me directly, and he wrote this incredibly sweet email that was, you know, basically like, I do not have time for this, but I will make the time for this. I bet the stories will be great. And at that point, I still had like 5 stories to write before the collection was complete. And when we looked at the timing of like when he would need to read the the manuscript to be able to turn around the intro in time for the book to be printed, it was like, oh shit, now I need to write these stories. I knew some of them were previously published, some of them were going to be previously unpublished. And so it was like one more fitting burst of how he's always been a figure of great inspiration to me, that it was like, well, now I got to write something like five completed short stories and thankfully turn them around in time and sent them to him. And yeah, Eric, your supposition is 100% correct. It still feels so fucking surreal. I was able to like compartmentalize it for a long time, because when he said he would do it, it was like, holy shit, that is a dream come true. But it hasn't happened yet. And like, you know, maybe it will just be just like a one page sort of like, writers, aren't they great? You know, and just not very in depth. I literally, there's a paperback from hell called The Abyss by Jer Cunningham, which is a really fun book. And that has a blurb on the cover, a King blurb, that says something like, it comes very close to being great. Because, ooh, you know, ouch, they were so, ouch, you know, King blurb is such a special thing. So like, they were like, fuck it. Like, that's, it's still an endorsement. And I was like, maybe it'll be something like that. Maybe it'll be kind of lukewarm or just, you know, sort of generic. There's no guarantee. And, or maybe he'll just pull out. Maybe he'll just be like, I don't have the time. And that's
Nat
that.
Nat Cassidy's font is really, yeah, one, exactly, of the best fonts.
It's the equivalent of my theater background when we're like, you guys look like you were having so much fun up there. Like, when you hear that feedback after a show, you know, it was a
Those
was a
stories
real...
are very interesting. Yeah, they're so interesting.
They had titles, and they came to a period. And boy, what an accomplishment.
Really good grammar. Really?
Yeah. All the commas were mostly in the right place. So it wasn't until he turned the text in that, like, the surreality jets, like, really turned to 11, and suddenly it was like I now have the task ahead of me of, like, actually metabolizing unambiguously good news. Uh-huh. I'm kind of, right, ill-equipped for that. Yeah. And so it's been, you know, it's literally a dream come true. I've been sending King material since I was 13, just to be like, hey, what do you think of this? And like, it would always get sent back, because of course it would. Like, you can't send someone unsolicited material. I'm sure he didn't even see it. It just, like, it would bounce off of his assistant at the time. But the prospect of him engaging with anything I wrote, you know, for any length of time, let alone like spending thought and energy and opening up a fucking Word doc to like type words about it, is just like a pinnacle pipe dream of mine. And we'll get into this when we talk about Nightmares and Dreamscapes. But I kind of realized as I was revisiting this collection how it is like a uniquely important collection to me too in my development as a writer and a reader, because of his intro and because of his story notes. I've since been lucky enough as a novelist to have carved a little piece for myself where my forewords and afterwards have a lot of fans, and they're kind of looked at as an intricate part of reading a novel of mine. And that's all because of Stephen King, and that's all because of collections like Nightmares and Dreamscapes. And his, as I was telling to him when he sent the intro in, I, you know, fumbled over myself trying to thank him profusely, and I was like, "Your nonfiction has always meant as much to me as your fiction." Like, I kind of have learned to even think about talking about writing, analyzing writing, because of the way you have through the course of your intros and forewords. And, you know, I've long had that Book of the Month Club collection, Secret Windows, that kind of collects a lot of his essays. I fucking subscribe to Entertainment Weekly just for his columns. Like, all of his musings and analysis and stuff like that have also been as formative to me as, you know, The Shining or, you know, any of his fiction work. And so to see him treat something I've written with the same level that, like, I've read him treat Shirley Jackson or William Goldman. That's who wrote Lord of the Flies, right? Yep. William Goldman.
Golding.
Yeah, it was like, yeah, close. William Goldman wrote Misery.
Yes.
The screenplay. So yeah, to like just to just see him pay like that level of energy and respect and enthusiasm, it's just fucking it's mind blowing. I am so grateful and I'm so stunned. I kind of feel poleaxed a little bit with gratitude, like I've been punched in the face in a good way. And yeah, I'm so excited for people to read it, read the intro. It is as it was not what I was, you know, kind of allowing myself to think might happen. Like it is a quintessentially Kingian intro. It's funny. It's warm. It's thoughtful. He throws some fucking Jerry Lee Lewis in there. I was like, hell yeah, this is amazing.
Some Jimmy Swaggart.
Jimmy Swaggart. Yeah, it is as full of reference and wit as anyone could hope. So
and
I
also
am...
I got to point out shock that he's reading now and excited about a generation, which he should have been already. I don't know why he's shocked about it, but where he makes note of. Like, oh, wait a minute, Nat was born in 81.
Yeah.
Which, we're 81. I'm an 81 baby. Congrats.
Hell yeah. Class of
2000. 45. We got to get our buttholes checked this year.
Yep.
Just FYI. But yeah,
I did mine
like,
2 years ago, and it was wonderful.
Oh,
I highly
great.
Recommend it.
Great.
Best nap you'll have.
But I mean professionally, by a doctor. So, but yeah, he makes note in there. It's just like, in I guess maybe my work might have influenced his stuff in the way that I was influenced by, you know, Matheson and Bradbury and all
yeah.
that stuff. And I don't know that moment where he kind of steps aside, going, "Oh shit, yeah, I forget. I guess I kind of." You know, my work might have had something to do with this new generation.
Yeah,
never occurred to him.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Somebody should tell him that they were appreciative and influenced by
his
work.
Are his fans so silent? They should start podcasts or something.
No more Stephen King podcasts. I'm drawing the line. We don't need any more competition. But yeah, no, it's a wonderful intro, man. And
it stressed me out though, because what he's talking about at one point in there about how he's going to make excuses to get out of this.
Yeah.
And he's like, I might come up with a few plausible reasons. Maybe I have an inoperable brain tumor. And I was like, wait a minute. You're not allowed to joke about that.
Don't say that shit.
Steve.
Don't say that.
Definitely
shit.
Not this year. Fucking people are dropping like flies.
Seriously.
In 2026. Like, no. See, at the time of this recording, Bruce Campbell just announced that he's got a non-curable but treatable cancer, and it seems like every other day we're getting somebody gone. So no jokes about Stephen King and brain tumors. Is
amen to that.
So you need to go back to your editor and say we got to redact that part from
Cut
the intro.
Strike that.
Yeah.
Another thing that like totally blew my mind in the intro is that he mentioned kind of getting to know me first through Talking Scared podcast,
right.
where I've guested on a few times, where we are doing Stephen King deep dives.
Yeah.
And so that was also kind of mind-blowing that he thought of me first as a critic.
Uh-huh.
It was like, oh, you know, I didn't want to read his stuff because I figured he was just a critic.
Yeah. And he thought you were going to be boring.
Yeah. I was like, oh my God, why he hadn't
bored
any of my books.
He was at this. He's like, you know, something about Nat Cassidy that I just don't like, but.
What did you say about his favorite story that got under his skin? What were you deep diving? You were talking about you didn't like the baby talk bullshit and Lisey story, or what's the, I don't know.
Man, I have said that I struggled with Lisey story a little bit, but I've since warmed to Lisey story. Once I listened to the audiobook, in fact, was that Mayor Cunningham? Does a beautiful job in the
Mayor
linguistic
Winningham.
Quirks of Mayor Winningham. That's it. Yeah, the linguistic quirks of that book have grown on me.
To clumsily segue from your short stories, I could go into I'm the world's slowest reader. I will put that up front. So I haven't finished your book, but I did tell you as we were jumping on before we started recording that if you see bags under my eyes, it's because I went to bed at a normal hour and I decided to start reading what I thought was a short story, but it was actually your novella, Rest Stop. And and I was just so pulled in that I didn't go to sleep until like 3:30 in the morning. So you're fucking up my sleep schedule. Thank you so much for that.
Good.
But it is wonderful. The only thing that I'll say, if you're not familiar with it, if you're listening to this and not familiar with it, is this is the closest feeling to Stephen King that I've got outside of his bloodline. I'll put, you know, so there's,
damn, that when, is
when
some
I
high price.
When I was reading Rest Up, because you spend so much time in the head of Abe, the main character, before the shit goes down, it feels so effortless that I was just like, oh, this is exactly what I love about Stephen King, is like, by the time the horror starts, you're already invested in, you know, the people involved in, or in this person case, the person involved. And then once the horror starts, it is so messed up. And it's like also Stephen Graham Jones's wet dream of there's snakes and spiders and all sorts of crazy shit that happens. It's not just a guy in a mask that shows up at this gas station. And so I don't know. I'm trying to dance around it, but saying that if you like Stephen King and you haven't read any of Nat's work, I highly, highly, highly recommend you get your hands on this book when it comes out and start reading this stuff. Because I wouldn't go so far as to call you an heir apparent. We will see soon. But I will say that it's very rare for me to get that feeling I get from reading a Stephen King novel with any other author that doesn't share his blood. So,
Well, thank you
so much. And you can quote me on that.
You can quote me too, Nat. I would say comes close to being great.
Hey, I would put that on the cover if we didn't already have a good blurb.
So, Anthony Bresnahan, you know, as Stephen King says.
Thing I loved about Rest Stop is it's really funny.
Yeah,
it's funny as hell. You know, he's losing it. I don't want to say exactly what happens, but it's about a guy who's stuck in a rest stop toilet, and there's creepy crawlies and blood and mayhem, and it gets quite funny.
Thank you. I mean, that is an important part of horror, or of the horror experience to me, and I imagine to you guys too, as King fans and as students of like what makes these stories work. Like, there is a level of existential absurdity that you have to acknowledge, and you have to water it a little bit. You can overwater it, like that can like take the stakes out of the thing. But like, how do you not crack a few jokes when you're losing your mind or when you're stuck in a situation like that? So like, finding the humor in these sort of things is incredibly important to me, and I think it is kind of a natural impulse for anyone who has found these stories, I was going to say source material. It's not quite source material, but like, you know, these stories that we've been reading for as long as we've been readers. How do you not honor that sort of balance? I mean, you look at the stories in Nightmares and Dreamscapes even, and like, there's moving fingers and chattering teeth and bathroom ghosts and all that mm-hmm. stuff. Like, it is sometimes de facto absurd. And another one of my like North Star artistic inspirations is David Lynch. And one of the things I love about David Lynch is that he often will show in his movies what it is like when the joke keeps repeating and it stops being funny and starts being uncanny. And there's a similar sort of delight in that, I think, you know, just setting up these like larger than life situations and characters and then being like, yeah, but what if it is really happening?
Mm-hmm. It's so good. I could do a deep dive into this story and all the things that I loved about it, but I don't want to spoil it for those who might not have read it. It was previously published, you said, so it is out there, but I would highly recommend picking up this book. So
thank
get
you.
To your pre-orders in now.
Yes, please. Yeah.
Well,
it's
what I like
important.
Too is the way your character uses pop culture as a way of understanding weird stuff. You know?
Yeah.
For those of us who sort of speak a second language of The Simpsons, like as a, this is just like an episode of that, or referencing a Stephen, we do it with Stephen King. Something terrible happens in the world, and we're like, oh, this is like something out of one of his stories. And
presidents like Greg Stilson, maybe.
Yeah. You've got this big hairy spider that drops out of the ceiling at one point, and he's talking about John Entwistle and Boris the Spider. I love that song, and I think Entwistle is an underrated part of the Who, so I enjoy
one of the greatest bass players of all time. Mm-hmm. Amen.
Believe it or not, I remember when he died, I was working at the AP, and it was my job to write his obituary, and it wasn't one of those ones we had prepared, so I had like three rock and roll encyclopedias out, just like trying to get the timeline down and writing it a sentence at a time.
Yeah.
So whenever see John Entwistle, I remember that stressful time in my own life. But it was
rude of you, John Entwistle.
It was. I'm sure he had a worse day.
I mean, he was partying in a hotel room, so maybe not.
Maybe it was not so bad. Yeah.
Yeah. That is odd. One of the last things that I did when I was at Slash Film, you know, as like a part-time writer there, which I was doing concurrently with the KingCast for a couple of years, was one, you know, this is they'd been taken over by this other big company, and so they were starting to do things more standard and writing clickbaity kind of stuff. And but one thing that they did that they started moving me into, because I guess I'm pretty good at it, was writing obituaries in advance, right? And I'm like, and so when I left there, the one of the last things that I'd written for them was a Gene Hackman obituary, and about 2 years before he actually passed, and I know they published it, but they must have done a ton of work, because it's, you know, the obituary for somebody like Gene Hackman is like just praising his films and praising maybe the undersung stuff that people don't know as much as Superman or, you know, Unforgiven or whatever, right? And I remember, and I still didn't look at it. I didn't want to look at it, what they did, but the way that he passed, you know, is such a huge part of the story of his passing. It's not just, oh, he peacefully went. It was, you know, it's a sad death that he had, that, like, I can't imagine how they balance those two. So it is such this weird practice of like banking death stories in advance that, you know, you understand why it has to happen, but it is really weird. I can't imagine that tightrope of having to massage let's celebrate this man's life, you know, compared to, you know, framing it how he passed. So
it's that great Dana Carvey sketch of having to, as Tom Brokaw, having to record, because Tom Brokaw's about to go on vacation, but he has to record a bunch of blurbs for, what was it, Jimmy Carter's death or something like that. Right. All the many ways he could die while he's on vacation.
That's it's real. That's real life. But also, let's dive into Nightmares and Dreamscapes.
Yeah.
I want to start by asking our origin stories for Nightmares and Dreamscapes specifically. And the reason that I say this is because this is a fairly formative collection for me, because this was the first new Stephen King book that was published when I was actively reading Stephen King. This came out in 93. I was 12 years old, but I'd started reading King in sixth grade, so this must have been seventh or eighth grade, I guess, when this came out. I remember Needful Things was still like at the used bookstores, the hardcover, so that was like a fairly new King thing that had come out. But this is the first one where I'm a King fan. I'm reading through everything that he's doing. The new Stephen King book is Nightmares and Dreamscapes, and because of that, it marks a very specific time. And this is also a pivotal year for me, because this is when I moved from Northern California, where I was born and raised, to Austin, which, you know, essentially changed the course of my life for forever. You know, if I know Austin, there was no me falling into the movie coverage, you know, scene. No, Ain't It Cool, you know, getting to know all these incredible filmmakers and stuff, which then, you know, and people like Scott Wampler, and then no KingCast, right? So it's a huge move for me, and I will, in Nightmares and Dreamscapes is always a part of it for me, because like I it's such a giant fucking doorstop of a collection that like I have vivid memories of taking this as my only carry-on on the airplane, because I couldn't, you know, I couldn't have two items that size, right? And so I remember reading this on the flight to this, you know, to my new home, essentially. This is before Kindles and iPads. So, you know, there's not only do I, you know, have a good, you know, a decent connection to a lot of the stories here, you know, the book itself and the release of this book, you know, marks a very specific time. And it's like the Ratatouille flashback thing whenever I see that cover and, you know, hold the actual, you know, book in my hands, I feel like that 12-year-old on that airplane. So that's my origin story with this. Do you guys have any sort of connection, you know, of equal or lesser value to or greater value to my little weird happenstance there?
I mean, we're on the same timeline. Exactly. I, for some reason, I don't think I engaged with this book until it was paperback. So it must have been the next year. But all, like, my first live King release that as a King fan was either Rosematter or Insomnia. I forget which one came first. But I was already like a King obsessive by that point, and, you know, been reading the back catalog. And so this was the first short story collection that was new when I was reading it, for sure. I read it obsessively, and then it became from pretty much when it was released until at some point through college, I would always go to bed listening to either a book on tape or a stand-up comedy album. And if it was a stand-up comedy album, it was almost always like a George Carlin album. And if it was a book on tape, it was almost always Nightmares and Dreamscapes or Skeleton Crew, the books on tape. And if it was Nightmares and Dreamscapes, it was almost always the first cassette, which was the introduction and Whoopi Goldberg reading Suffer the Little Children and Tim Curry reading Crouch End. Yeah. And God, there were a couple of other ones. But like, so I have that. There's like a handful of stories from this particularly that are not only drilled into my consciousness and subconsciousness, but the delivery that the celebrity narrators gave them, including King reading the intro, are basically embedded in my head like music. So I think of them all the time. I can still hear King saying, "And Steve believed him," when talking about voting for Nixon, or half of Tim Curry's line deliveries in Crouch End. And I can hear Whoopi Goldberg saying, "Miss Sidley was her name and teaching was her game." Like, there's just something about this collection, even though it's not my favorite of the collections, but it's taken on this almost mimetic quality, that again, like I was saying earlier, like I kind of forgot that, yes, when I talk about how writing forwards and afterwards to me is something I learned from Stephen King writ large, when I really drill down to like the specifics of it, it's the intro to Nightmares and Dreamscapes and the story notes to Nightmares and Dreamscapes that were the ones I kept going back to again and again and again. You know, when you look at the three original short story collections, when you look at Night Shift, Skeleton Crew, and then Nightmares and Dreamscapes, Night Shift is like a perfect rock album, right? It's all killer, no filler. And then Skeleton Crew is like just a batshit double album. And sure, it's got excess and it's, you know, maybe bloated in parts, but like, name one story you would kick out of there. You can't. Yeah. They're all great. The highs are amazing. This one is like, to bring it back to The Who, this one is like Odds and Sods. It's B-sides and outtakes and live versions, and just like there's fucking screenplays, yeah, and New Yorker essays.
There's a screenplay
essays
and a poem.
Yeah, it's bananas. There's a parable at the end just kind of tacked on for right, for shits and giggles. But because
there's
of that,
notes
I realized,
on his son's Little League, yeah, you know, season, right? You know, yeah.
And then a baseball poem to follow
right
it up.
Right, right.
But I think I realized that this, because of that, and because of the formative relationship with this, it also is my platonic ideal for what a collection should be. So even when I was putting together I Know a Place, it was like, you know, this is maybe an unwise or silly thing to say about something you're promoting, but it was almost like, it is more important to me that this is an interesting collection than just a quality collection. And, you know, hopefully the quality is there. The idea is that the quality is there. But I would much rather... I find it much more enjoyable, I think, because of my formative experience with Nightmares and Dreamscapes, to have no fucking idea what the next story is going to be in form or in content, rather than just knowing the next one is going to be a really good short story, and the next one is going to be a really good short story. There's something about the absolute bananas eclecticism of this book that I find so delightful and so singular, that even though it is not my per se favorite, like, it is such a delightful reminder that, like, you know, there are no rules to what you can or can't put in a collection.
And sometimes how you say that it's a whiplash from story to story. Sometimes you get two vampire stories back to back, like, yeah, Flyer and Popsy.
Maybe it's right? The same vampire story. I don't know. Maybe there's a story about bat people like 100 pages later.
Can we talk about the cover? You mentioned you got the paperback. Can we just say the cover for the hardback, I think it was by Rob Wood.
Oh yeah,
the scarecrow in the middle of the road is so bitchin'.
At dusk,
that is such a great cover.
Yeah,
it's like the side of a van, right? Yeah.
Why would they do? Yeah. Why would they do this?
This is like something you would buy at like Home Goods to hang on a wall in a Southwest home.
If you're listening to this, it's like a half sun, half moon kind of foil embossed cover. It's weird because we're starting to leave that era where, you know, the covers of the 70s and 80s, the paperback stuff was always so inventive. Like, I always go back to the Salem's Lot cover, which is looks pure black unless you look at it at an angle and you realize it's the face of, I think it's one of the Glick kids or something. It's a child vampire, I think, with a one ruby drop of blood. Yeah. So if you're looking at it from a distance, it just looks like a black cover with a drop of blood on it, but then you can see the embossed on it. You know, yeah, I don't know. Yeah.
Decayed the paper is too. Like, it's really crappy paper.
Mine is the same way, and I gotta say, I have not flipped through this in a while, and I was fucking humbled by how small the font is now. I was like, oh my god, I'm so old now. This is so hard to read.
But why do you think they changed it?
It's a good question.
A lot of those covers, like Christine, Pet Sematary, Firestarter, they would look exactly the same in the paperback.
Yeah. I mean, for its generic sort of blahness, there is something about it that is very arresting. Like, it's metallic, it's got that foil glow to it. This is what, 93, so maybe it's, you know, the beginning of the push to be like, he's also literary, come on folks, he's not just a scaremonger.
I wonder if it's also trying to confuse people and think it's a new Stephen King thing they haven't read, you know.
I haven't seen this
maybe
cover
a
before.
Double dip for the fans, or you know, making it look like he's got a new book out.
It's trying aggressively to not be scary, though.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like, the scarecrow is frightening. Scarecrow in the middle of a road, the old country road, is that's freaky.
Yeah, the hardcover is leaning into the nightmares part of it, and the soft cover is leaning into the dreamscapes part of it.
It's all about duality, Brez. That's all.
I guess so.
It's weird, too. I have a, like, touch of synesthesia, also. I'm very easily influenced by cover and like album art or book cover color schemes. So when I think of any of the stories in this book, they do have this weird like gold blue metallic sort of sheen to them. And it, like, flipping through some of them, I kind of forgot how full blooded a lot of them can be, because they have kind of just like crystallized with that similar sort of aesthetic.
Yeah.
I bought mine for $5.24 from the Farmore pharmacy store.
I'm sure my cover or my hardback came from Half Price Books.
I couldn't afford the hardcovers. The only hardcover I ever bought was Needful Things when it first came out. I'm a few years older than you guys, so I was in college when I got the paperback. That was my freshman year of college, and I remember laying on that top bunk reading the 10 o'clock people and pretty nostalgic.
Yeah, we're going to do Ken Burns style narration about our times now.
Dearest Martha, I just saw the motion picture Jurassic Park. My goodness.
I thought the dinosaur was going to jump right out of the screen. Welcome to the mid-roll ad read. I want to tell you all about a new book coming out from Penguin Random House called The Fox and the Devil. Think Killing Eve would have been perfect with a few vampires in the mix? Well, then you're gonna love The Fox and the Devil by Kirsten White. It's about a vampire hunter's daughter who will stop at nothing to find the woman who took her father's life and her own heart. Alison Saft calls The Fox and the Devil grisly and electrifying and says, Kirsten White never misses. Prepare to be obsessed. I gotta make sure this is on Mallory O'Meara's radar, by the way. It sounds so up her alley. Serial killers, you got vampires, sensual sapphic romance. That feels like it checks all the horny genre boxes to me. So yes, I am forwarding this right on to Mallory as soon as I'm done with this read. But yes, please go pick up The Fox and the Devil by Kirsten White. It's available wherever books are sold. Now let's get back to the show. When you're talking about Nightmares and Dreamscapes, I've talked, you know, obviously this is a giant collection. There's 24 stories in this. Obviously, we would be here for about 7 hours if we were going to go through them one by one. We did one of our anniversary shows where we went through each and every story, and I think that's a 3.5 hour or something episode. But that's a really fun one if you want to go back. Our anniversary shows for the first 3 or so years were always us doing something fun with one of the short story collections and having returning guests come in and do little bits, or, you know, presenting one of the stories. So when you're talking about getting 24 people back by the end of it, that became a crazy thing. But Wampler and I had decided we were going to do a horror slasher tale that was going on. So the setting of that anniversary episode is everybody's coming up to the campfire to tell their ghost story and to relay what each story is, and then we talk a little bit about it. And then after they tell their story, they're excused to go back to the cabin, and they're always murdered by a masked killer on the way back. So yeah,
beautiful.
Patton Oswalt coming on to talk about Crouch End or whatever, and then he gets murdered by somebody in a mask, you know, off camera, and, you know, screams into the microphone awkwardly, and all that, and we have fun stuff with that. So the whole point is, you know, we've done the full comprehensive collection before. We don't have the time to do that now, so I figured what might be a good idea is for us to pick our three favorite stories from the collection, and then we can talk about why they're our favorites, like what grabs us about them, that kind of stuff. How do you guys want to do this? Do you guys want to lay out each one of us throws out our three favorites all at once, you know, or do you want to do like a one at a time kind of thing?
Let's do Nats first. He's the guest.
Oh, man. I was prepared to just pick ones that you guys didn't pick.
One of the points of saying, like, we could all go, okay, in order, like, from, you know, on my screen, it's Brez, Nat, and me. We could go Brez, Nat, and me, and then we could be like, here are our three favorites, and then we can then, you know, we know which titles we're working with. Or we could just make it a surprise and roll with it. So it's totally up to you guys. Obviously, we haven't figured that shit out in advance, and we're doing it live, baby. So.
The more chaotic it is, the more befitting it is to this this collection.
for sure. So yeah, it sounds like we should probably do one at a time for their favorite three, and then we can jump through. Starting with Nat, I feel like that's the natural one. We're gonna put Nat on the spot.
All right. I, as a Libra, this is anathema to me, picking favorites. I wrote down like half of the table of contacts. I was surprised. I started with just like, oh, what do I think my favorites are? And then I was like, oh, but I can't forget that one or that one or that one. So there are very few of them that I would kind of leave on the cutting room floor. I think my favorite, the one that is calling to me as the favorite right now, is Omni's Last Case.
Nice.
I love that story. And there's just something about, let's bring it back to John D. MacDonald. Like, I love noir, hard-boiled fiction. And when I read this book, I hadn't really read any before. So in a way, this was my first taste of like a Raymond Chandler sort of story, besides fucking Who Framed Roger Rabbit. And so it was, I kind of fell in love with that voice right away. And then you add to it, I'm always a sucker for a kind of metafictional sort of narrative about, you know, authors and their work and stuff like that. I'm sure an adult reading this, when it came out, would maybe be like, oh, this isn't the most mind-blowing twist I've ever read. But for me at the time, I was like, oh my God, you can do that? You can have a story about a writer writing himself into his story and then somehow evicting his main character and swapping places with him? Mm-hmm. Like, it's baby's first At Swim Two Birds. It's like a really cool sort of introduction to what the relationship between author and work can be. And, you know, that is a thing that has obsessed King for most of his career as well. So it certainly wasn't my first time like reading that from him. I'd probably already read The Dark Half by this point and The Ballad of the Flexible Bullet and Word Processor of the Gods and all these things. Mm-hmm. But I had never read it in a pastiche voice like this. And so that was, like, from this point on, I became a sucker for hard-boiled fiction and started reading Raymond Chandler and John MacDonald and blokes of that ilk. I love that book, that story. I have a real soft spot for it.
Remind the readers exactly, or the readers, remind the listeners, the people who read with their ears. Do you want to remind them what this one's about?
Oh, and I should say the audiobook, I think, is read by Robert Parker, another mystery writer. And he does a great job narrating this story. So it just there's something about his grizzled voice that just makes it all the better. Let's see. It's been a while since I actually like deep dove it.
You don't have to go about, beat by beat, but yeah.
Page one.
Yes.
Lights rise on a private detective who is, you know, kind of living his private detective life. And he comes back to his office and he finds this man waiting for him, basically holding him up at gunpoint. And it turns out that Omni is then informed, Omni the private detective, that he is a work of fiction. And his author, his life has been falling apart. And he basically evicts Omni out of his fictional world and takes his place. And it ends, I'm forgetting the mechanism by which he actually evicts him. Maybe it's not even clarified. But it ends with now a private detective noir character waking up in the real world being like, ah, fuck, I've got shingles and I've got like all these like everything hurts. And it's a great sort of subversion of, you know, we look at noir stories as being hard-boiled and gritty and full of unpleasant characters, but like they don't have to deal with a lot of the mundane indignities that we do in the real world. And now he, if I'm remembering correctly, then ends on this note of like, I'm gonna find my way back into that fucking story and kick that motherfucker out of there. So yeah, it's very satisfying.
It's great, and it kind of leans into the maybe the wish fulfillment, you know, of an author wanting to literally live in the world that they create, and that this is so much better. And I kind of get the feeling, hearing King talk about writing Dark Tower, that maybe he, if he could Omni himself into it, like he didn't literally swap places with his character, but yes, it's, you know, but I get that feeling like at a certain point the fictional reality is more enticing than the actual reality. And you know,
And this is part of Light Lisi's story too.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. For as chaotic and, you know, high stakes as a story can be, it is a story. There is actual narrative, like safety in there. I mean, you've already mentioned fucking President Stilson and like, wouldn't it be great to live in a world where that would be the end of a political career instead of this fucking boundless nightmare that we're in, where like they would probably say that baby was Antifa and had it coming, and we're all holding babies up to guns now because it's just the thing we do to show our support and allegiance.
There's an instant AI, you know, fucking image of, you know, of Jesus holding a baby up or something. That's the world we live in. Do we want to go like one at a time and until we go through, or do we want to force Nat to come up with two others of his favorites right now? Brez, what do you think?
I think let's hear Nat's two others, and we'll just keep ours short because you know, this should be his.
But if I say one that is one of yours, feel free to let me know. I can switch. Right. I can switch on a dime, baby. I think my second favorite one. Let's see. I almost said Sorry Right Number, but maybe I'll save that for the wild card. I'm gonna go with Home Delivery. I love Home Delivery. There's something about Home Delivery that reminds me of one of my favorite stories from Skeleton Crew, which is The Reach. There's a melancholiness to Home Delivery that I find really appealing. It is a great exercise in world building. It was written for I think Skip and Spencer put together a anthology about George Romero. You know, what if that happened? It basically kind of what happened with the Stand anthology that just came out, but set in the universe of George Romero's Dead universe. So I'm blanking on if it's set on an island, but it's somewhere in Maine and a pregnant young woman. Is it? It's one of the islands.
It's one of the islands. Yeah.
Is it Little Tall? It's one of the islands, and a pregnant woman is kind of having to deal with being pregnant during the backdrop of a zombie apocalypse. And that sounds kind of generic in a sense, but he fills it with, you know, there's a fucking like found footage horror movie, like right in the middle of it, where there's like transcript of astronauts being eaten by severed heads.
Hmm.
And there's a touch of like Lovecraftian worm imagery and you know, killer comets and all that stuff. It's just weird. And to kind of background that with the foreground of this story of a woman who has to kill her reanimated husband and then just kind of deal with the fact that she's going to have to give birth at home. It will be a home delivery. Not only that, to find a sense of almost the end of Mist, the novella levels of hope and gumption kind of sums up some of the things that Stephen King does so uniquely well. You know, there's so many emotions that are being played so superbly throughout this story. You get the gross out, you get the horror, you get the terror, and then it ends with this feeling of guarded but kind of justified hope that, you know, she's going to be okay, the baby's going to be okay, maybe there will be a way out of this. It's a really cool story for something that could have just been like, this Night of the Living Dead, but in Maine.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
No, this is one of mine. This is one of my top three.
Damn it!
So I've made you do all the work in explaining it. I love it. But I love it for exactly what you're just talking about there, because it's King very rarely does zombies. That's not really a thing he does. Even though so many, like, The Mist is very Night of the Living Dead. You know, yeah.
Those are ghouls or revenants.
Yeah, you could look at Creepshow and, like, you know, the, you know, Father's Day and Creepshow. There's definitely reanimated corpses have made their way, but when I, you know, I'm talking about like The Stand is a zombie story without zombies, right? Mm. It's like, you know, I could point to, like I was saying, The Mist is a zombie story without zombies. Like, playing within
Cell.
Those.
We got Cell.
Yeah, and we got cell phone zombies. Yeah, so maybe he shouldn't do zombies a lot. But I love his approach here specifically because he is trying to get that Romero feel, you know, that deep character, you know, how does society interact with this? I love that the society on the island, it isn't panic. It's like, okay, and then the guys go, okay, this is just, we know the graveyard's going to, you know, start to erupt with corpses. We're going to arm up, you know, everybody else gets into play. I don't know. There's something very soothing almost about, oh, this is safeguard of society happening here, you know, in a way that you don't normally get with these kind of stories. And then when she's attacked, it's not because her husband's coming out of the graveyard. It's because he had died at sea.
Yeah.
And it's his, like, waterlogged corpse is making its way onto the island and back home, you know, which is very interesting to me and very Stephen, very EC-ish, you know. So you get a little bit of that goofy, you know, Tales from the Crypt, loving kid Stephen King, and then you get, you know, a lot of that, the character work of older Stephen King, and then you get the Romero influence. So I'm a big, big fan of home delivery, and I think it's one of the great examples of him actually getting to play in that, in the zombie world with the zombie rules as we know them.
Yeah, and it's refreshing too, to anytime there's a reminder of the kind of the rogue satellite reason for the zombie apocalypse in Night of the Living Dead. Like, mm-hmm. he takes that little bit, because he's such a fan of the genre, mm-hmm. too, mm-hmm. That he takes that little bit from the movie and it fucking runs with it, and it's delightful. You can feel the delight coming off of the page.
For sure. All right, so what's your third? We got number three. You got to pick.
Man, threes are always the hardest.
It means you don't like any of the other ones.
Right.
This, by the way.
This says everything about me. Whatever I pick next. Dedication. No, it will not be Dedication. although, you know, I will say, there's something about Dedication that I respect the hell out of for all of its questionable nature.
Just a reminder, I was 12 years old when I read this story for the first time.
It was a mind-blowing story.
Dedication is the one about the mother who kind of uses witch doctor hoodoo to... she wants a son, and apparently the perfect father for her son is a racist famous author that comes and stays at this hotel where she's a maid. And part of the ritual is her gathering the semen he leaves on a bed sheet.
Yeah.
And she eats it, I believe, if I remember correctly, and thus through the magic of witchcraft is born a child, and it's called Dedication because that child grows up to be a successful author and dedicates his latest book to his mother. So
yeah, and what I respect about it, it hasn't aged well. For starters, I don't think it aged well from the moment it was born. There are some, let's say, racial insensitivities that are clunkers. It is a challenging story on a number of fronts to read. But as he even says in his notes at the end, which made me go like, yeah, you know what? That's an interesting point that I can respect this point. He was like, look, there are plenty of things I could say about this story, and you know, I'm not going to apologize for it. If I felt it was a story that needed apology, I wouldn't have included it. But you got to admit, in so many words, that this story has teeth. And what are you reading a collection for if you don't want to get bit a little bit? And on that front, I'm like, yeah, you're right. Like, we wanted disturbing stories, and there, once you read this story, it disturbs you on a number of levels. So it is unforgettable.
I want you to be a little bit afraid every time you step into my parlor. I want you to be unsure about how far I'll go or what I may do next. And Mission accomplished.
I fucking respect the hell out of that. But it shan't be my third pick.
Okay.
I'm going to go with... There's so many good ones. Can I... Hey, fuck it. I'm a guest. I can do what I want.
You do whatever.
I'm going to do Night Flyer plus Popsy.
Ooh. Twofer.
I'm combining them.
The vampire
Shot
double feature.
And Chaser.
That's right. Because they, you know, he even teases maybe they're related in the notes at the end. Night Flyer is a great, just capital P pulp story. It brings back a familiar character from the Dead Zone, Rick Dees, who's a kind of tabloid mudslinger. And
he got married and hyphenated his name. He married Miss Nuts.
Yeah. So. Yeah. The Connecticut D's Nuts.
Sorry. I had to. Okay. Go ahead. Please continue.
kind of becomes obsessed with, this mysterious plane that is a little indie dual engine. I forget the terminology for him, a prop plane, that
it's
is
like
going
a Cessna,
from,
wasn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's a Cessna. Yeah. That's right. That's the first time I heard that brand name.
Mm-hmm.
That is going from independent airfield to independent airfield and leaving a trail of bodies in its wake. And eventually he catches the perpetrator in the act, and it is a coffin with wings, essentially. There's graveyard dirt in the plane. He doesn't find the perpetrator at first until he discovers all these mangled bodies and runs to the bathroom to throw up. And as he's in the bathroom voiding his stomach, he looks in the mirror and sees, bloody urine arcing into the urinal behind him because the vampire is currently in the bathroom with him. And he casts no reflection. And it is just such a stellar, pulpy image of him seeing bloody urine striking the urinal and realizing he's in this bathroom with this creature he's been pursuing. Since made into just a delightfully, you know, straight to VHS B movie with Miguel Ferreira that for some reason suddenly cuts to black and white during the climax.
It turns into a Fulci sequence
for
the massacre at the airport. Yeah.
It's so unnecessarily artsy, and it's just everything you want in a direct to VHS movie.
Yeah.
And then it's immediately followed up with this story of a guy who kidnaps a little kid because he's in dire straits and he needs the money. And the little kid the whole time is like, you know, let me go, mister. Wait till my Popsy finds you. You're going to be in big trouble when my Popsy catches you. And he's like, yeah, shut up, kid, shut up. Until his car door is ripped open and Popsy shows up, and it is this flying vampire thing who then slices his throat open. And the last thing he sees is the little boy cupping his hands and drinking his throat blood. There's absolutely no textual reason why we would think that they are related other than they're two capital V vampire stories right next to each other. And he kind of gives a little tease at the end in the notes that maybe they are related. But I don't know. There's something about it. You know, like, we all love, especially in the pre sort of Marvel takeover of popular culture, there was something so marvelous every time we would get a glimpse of a shared universe in these stories. Like, God, I remember as a kid being so excited anytime there was, like, a mention of that dog that went rabid up at the Camber garage. And you'd be like, oh, my God, I know who that is. And so there was, like, just kind of that encapsulated in this little table of contents that was just like, oh, could that be? Could that be the same monster? Are these related? Is this all a macroverse? Ironically enough, there's a Castle Rock story in this collection as well. Mm-hmm. But I kind of doubt we'll be talking about it. It's not one of people's favorite Castle Rock stories. But yeah, I love that 1-2 punch, and it made it all very experiential and just kind of a delightful little Easter egg within the reading of the stories back to back. And also kind of spoke again to like the fun that you can have with sequencing in a collection as well.
And what do you make of it being, because this is fairly early on in the collection when this comes up. So what do you make of that as somebody who you've just put together your own collection and you know, you essentially have to curate the ups and downs of the reader's experience here. So like, what do you think of the thought process King has putting those stories, not only back to back, but like right at the top of the collection?
That's a great question. And we put a lot of thought into the flow of things. And I do think this collection suffers from some of its sequencing. There's something about the flow that I think kind of highlights the jaggedness of the collection in ways that others don't. Even Everything's Eventual, which was famously decided by, tarot card pulls? and that's how we decided the order of the stories. That has a better flow to me than this one. But I did take a page from what works and what I have found didn't work as well in his collections and tried to embrace those lessons in this collection of mine. So it was things like what story complements the previous one, which one might feel like more of the same, which one might feel more of the same in an advantageous way, because there is several of the stories kind of echo the others as the table of contents goes on in I Know a Place. And that was, you know, so trying to figure out like how much space needs to be in between them for it to feel more like an echo and not feel like the author doesn't have enough imagination to come up with a different thing. There are even, you'll see in the table of contents, there are two meet cute stories that were initially supposed to go one after the other because I really wanted them to kind of speak to each other as narratives. And that was directly because of the Big Wheel stories in Skeleton Crew.
Yeah.
And then I decided to, you know, then it was like, oh, but also I love in Skeleton Crew how The Mist is followed up by Here There Be Tigers, which is a really short story. So maybe I should move the first Meet Cute story, which is really short, to be right after the novella. So it was like a lot of those sort of decisions that I was able to make because of witnessing through his collections what I felt worked best or what didn't work as good or you know, I don't know what his thought process would have been for this one other than, you know, this is how he felt it should be. And I think in the case of Night Flyer and Popsy, that works to its great effect.
Yeah, agreed. Well, I love your choices, and I'm surprised there's only one overlap. So, Brez, what would you say your top three are?
Well, let's see. I like The House on Maple Street. That's the one that he includes the illustration from Chris Van Allsburg's book, The Mysteries of Harris Burdick, which is a wonderful book in and of itself with a bunch of enigmatic images that Allsburg is best known, or Van Allsburg is best known for Polar Express and Jumanji and stories like that. He just has this sort of book of sort of surreal imagery. And the King family, as we learn from the notes at the end of Nightmares and Dreamscapes, Tabby decided everybody in the family should write a short story based on one of these bizarre images. And this is the one King wrote, and it has a little quaint little house in a neighborhood going up like a rocket into space. And he wrote this great story, which is a good intro story for kids, actually.
Yeah,
and I think he mentions at the end that he reads a Balderized version of it to students in elementary school. So that's a good one. I like The End of the Whole Mess.
Oh, love that one.
Which I don't know that the science in it is 100%. Like, it reminds me of the kind of story you might write when you're like just starting out, not in terms of the quality, but the idea of like, well, I'm going to make a potion that causes people to be peaceful. And well, how are we going to get everybody to ingest it? Let's put it in a volcano.
A volcano.
That feels like an episode of the Transformers, but...
but doesn't... just real quick, doesn't this... I don't know if you guys watch Pluribus, but isn't... Don't you get kind of similar vibes from Pluribus?
Yeah, well, that's what I was going to totally say. See
that. Oh, sorry. I totally stepped just, on your thing. Sorry.
No, you anticipated it, which is this notion of, if only... It's like, it reminds me of that Gore Vidal quote, there's no problem that cannot be solved if people would just do as I say.
Mm-hmm.
they end up just reducing the world to sleepwalkers in a sense, right? Like just everybody is just dim-witted and vacuous, and it just erases the intellect of the population, which I think it only took 30 years in TikTok to do.
Who needs a volcano?
The last one, I don't know if this is my favorite one. I think it's really interesting. Dolan's Cadillac, which I find to be like the Stephen King equivalent of one of those story problems they give you in elementary school. Like, if Jane boards a train that's moving 35 miles per hour and Bob gets on another train moving 50 miles an hour, it's like one of those math equations, but it involves revenge and killing a gangster by trapping his car in a pit outside of Las Vegas. I just love that he
Wily Coyotes this car into, yeah,
he
into
Wily
the ground.
Coyotes this car, and he has to figure out it has to be so long.
Yeah.
Otherwise, it'll just shoot right over like the Dukes of Hazzard.
It's the Stephen King equivalent of competency porn. It's like The Martian. It's just like, here, how do you do this? And then he does it, and it's told in excruciatingly fascinating.
And I remember, like, he traps him in there. Doesn't he? The gangster tries to shoot through the roof. But the car is just perfectly wedged in there, and then he fills it in and goes about his business. And
yeah,
I think there was a movie made from this. I never saw.
Terrible.
Yeah,
it is legitimate. It's probably one, if not the worst Stephen King movie ever made. It's up there. It is so bad. Yeah, Christian Slater is the.
Is it just boring? I just imagine it's like got to be mostly a guy digging a pit, right?
It's a little boring. It is more. It's more that the whoever directed it was caught in this post Matrix era, and it looks the joke
that
is
right that 360 degree turns like while he's digging a pit.
Well, no, the joke is that it looks like a an anti piracy ad. That's how it's you know, you wouldn't steal a car, you know. Remember, like, oh, we're really cool.
Yeah,
you
jagged know, editing.
It is that. It is like all
Saw
super
editing.
Saturized, and you know, and it is. It's trying to have personality when there's no personality. It is so bad. It is legitimately terrible. It's like I would rather watch some of the worst Children of the Corn sequels than watch that one again. So.
I just like the idea this should be taught in ninth grade elementary. Like, okay, here's some trigonometry for you.
You think these skills don't apply to real life? Well, let me tell you how it'll apply to real life. When your wife is murdered.
This like, is how you get
gangster,
revenge and
the,
get away
the
with it.
The gangster who's basically one step removed from Don Corleone.
He's You're like be this. Glad you learned about angles.
That departing story Las Vegas at moving at 90 miles an hour.
And there's also a little Poe in it too, right? Because he fills this in. It's in the road, so anybody like constantly people are driving over this corpse of this guy. So
I think there's even like a For the Love of God shout out in it, like a Cask of Amontillado sort of quote.
Sure.
That story was also the second side of the cassette tape that I listened to all the time of tape one of Nightmares and Dreamscapes, read by Rob Lowe. So I often associate Rob Lowe with Dolan's Cadillac.
There's a lot of great audiobooks in here.
I gotta get
Yardley
this
Smith does the Rainy Season, which is the Raining Frogs one.
Yeah, you get and Lisa Yardley Smith being Lisa Simpson. Simpson.
Yeah, and she does. She it's not like one of those voice
Maximum
actors.
Overdrive.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. Famously, Curtis,
the teen bride, right? Isn't she like a high school bride or something?
So, yeah, something like that. Yeah, she is one of the most annoying characters in it, and I love her to death.
Mm-hmm.
But the thing about her reading that one though is that a lot of these voice actors, you know, they don't sound like their character. She is. She just sounds like Lisa Simpson, right? That she's using her voice. So you're listening to the story being read about, you know, these man-eating frogs that fall from the sky, and it's fucking Lisa Simpson telling you the whole time.
Yeah, I love it. It's a great audiobook. It's now available on Audible, so you don't have to track down the cassettes.
Great.
Fucking classic. Jerry Garcia reads a story.
Yeah.
Grace Slick reads, you know, they got a hell of a band.
Yeah.
What does Jerry Garcia read? That's crazy.
He reads, is it My Little Pony?
My Pretty Pony.
Or My Pretty Pony? My Little Pony. Friendship is Magic.
My Little Pony.
Yeah.
And it goes on for 17 minutes of guitar solo.
Yes.
it's
a wonderful
collection.
And then the one that you always have to listen to, and this being my number one story of the collection, is Tim Curry reading Crouch End. So for me, Stephen King has so many different flavors that he plays around, and so many he can occupy pretty much any type and genre of horror, drama, melodrama, whatever, and always bring his own voice to it. And my favorite combination, the one that gets me excited every single time, is when he's delving into Lovecraft stuff. He doesn't do it super often, but when he does, it's a banger. You know, I think it's one of the reasons why I love Revival so much. It's one of the reasons why, you know, The Dreamers stood out to me, that story. When he plays with this existential horror, it's my favorite thing. And I don't think that and it's my favorite part of Fairy Tale, by the way, is when they get into the kind of old god stuff underneath the fairy tale land that's giving the evil princes power and all that shit. And Crouch End is the one where it's just the most blatant fuck it, you know, much like his, you know, he's got the Romero zombie story in here, and this is not only Lovecraft inspired. Fuck it, Cthulhu's in it. Fuck it, you know, all the shit I can't pronounce from Lovecraft is those monsters all make an appearance. And I also, something he does so well is that world next to our world thing. Whether it's represented in the Dark Tower by Thinnies, or, you know, Jack Sawyer being able to flip between, you know, realities. And I love the idea of driving to a location in the busiest, biggest city in the world and somehow ending up in, you know, a Lovecraftian dissolute nightmare, you know, that somewhere some line was crossed, and how can you get out? Fucked if I know. Good luck, you know. And so this is a story about two Americans that end up going to they're visiting one of the husband's colleagues in Crouch End, and they somehow end up in this world that is just, you know, slightly worse and more fucked up than ours. And it is still our recognizable reality, but there are rat boys, you know, and there are, newspaper headlines talking about horrors unleashed in the subway and, you know, and all this stuff that they find. To me, this is the one that I always go back to. This is the one that, like, not only is it my favorite in this collection, it's probably in my top three favorite King short stories of all time. The Jaunt, you know, holds my number one place, but this one is pretty high up there. And I also can speak for Wampler. This would have been his choice too. So we agreed on this one. And I mentioned Home Delivery, that again, it's one of my favorites. And when I was looking at the list as a kid, I probably would have picked Chattery Teeth or The Moving Finger. Those are the ones that, when I think about this collection, The Moving Finger, honestly, is the one that I think about first.
Same.
The first image is the finger popping up out of the drain pipe, and not only the finger, but when it like goes knuckle after knuckle after knuckle, and it becomes this long, there's something so grotesque about that. So even though that's the first image I see, it's still not my favorite. Like I when I was making my list, you know, the story that I settled on for my number three is Suffer the Little Children.
Yeah.
And it's,
I almost said that one.
it's a mean story. That's something that I really love about it. It's just this, it's a thing that plays with the, is she crazy or isn't she crazy kind of thing, but does it in a satisfying way, which I find to be an incredibly small needle to thread right there. You know, so it's about this teacher that slowly suspects that her students are being replaced by demonic doppelgangers, essentially. And it reaches a crescendo to the point where she so believes this that she says, well, these children have to be destroyed. And she starts taking them down to the basement one by one and killing them. And what I love about it is he could have easily gone ambiguous with this. Or even gone to the other extreme where this is just somebody, a teacher who had a mental break, her students were too much, she couldn't deal with it, and so the only explanation is that these evil children, you know, these things that are taking over these children are you know, just part of her imagination. But what it ends up being is she gets caught in the act, she is stopped, you know, a few kids in, I think she does her job, she kills a few of them. And she stopped before, like, the main one, the one that's always, you know, fucking doing shit behind her back, the one that she probably didn't like when he was actually human, right? The main one is about to get it. She stopped, and then we get this little essential coda where, nope, she was right. These things are taking over, and if they hadn't stopped her, she might have been able to stop whatever this invasion that's about to happen is. So it's a little, it's got a little invasion of the body snatchers to it. It's got the great get under your skin Stephen King writing that I love. It's you know, there's a mention where she's, you know, catches out of the corner of her eye. You know, I guess she can see a reflection, right? That's how she has a reputation for having, you know, as a strict teacher, mm-hmm. you know, having eyes in the back of her head. But the real thing is she can see a reflection, I believe, off of a clock on the corner of the wall. So when kids are goofing off behind her and she's at the chalkboard or whatever, she can call it out without turning around. So she feels like magical to the kids. But at the corner of her eye, she sees one of the kids change into this demonic thing. And then when she whips around, it's back to normal. Little things like that stick with me. And so I think looking at it now, I kind of went less with his melancholy stuff and more with his, these are the really effective horror tales in the book for me. So
I love that story so much. That was a Night Shift outtake, if I remember mm-hmm, correctly.
Yep. It was one of his older ones. Yeah.
Yeah. It lost its place to gray matter, in the table of contents, but, oh,
wasn't here, they, know, right? Here There Be Tigers. Was that Skeleton Crew?
That's Skeleton Crew.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Another teacher story. I do love it when he dips into his teacher background. Like, you know, this goes all, of course, back to Carrie, you know, what Carrie was inspired by, you know, real student that he, you know, that he had, or maybe an amalgam of students that he had. But, you know, I do love it when he reaches back into his pre-author work life. I mean, don't get me wrong, I love it, you know, and I have to love it, because if I didn't love his stories about authors, then I wouldn't be able to read 85% of his fucking work. But I do love it when he goes to the Mangler, or he goes to his teacher stories, or, you know, the things, his blue-collar jobs before becoming rich and famous. And there's just something about the texture of those stories that I always feel drawn to.
There's an element of that too, to both End of the Whole Mess and Crouch End. And this is one of the reasons why I love Story Notes so much, because, like, you read the End of the Whole Mess and you realize that is kind of a payee into his brother Dave, who was always too smart for his own good, and you can kind of then really, like, kind of sensorially experience the fraternal love and kind of admiration / fear in that story. And then Crouch End, like, in a weirdly appropriate to Lovecraft's own biography, you know, moving to Brooklyn and hating Brooklyn so much and writing the horror at Red Hook. Similarly, like, King moved to London for a little while, hated it, and then wrote this story about, you know, Americans in London being like, what the fuck is this place? Like, it's that experience comes through, and it enriches the story so much once you actually know that it's not just, you know, these stories weren't created in a vacuum. And that's one of the reasons why I love that intro, too. This is such a great quintessentially King intro to Nightmares and Dreamscapes. because of the way he talks about how, like, these stories are all just, they're homages to gullibility and to imagination, flights of fancy, because they're all coming from him as a kid, essentially, believing in all these tall tales and believing that the world is weirder than we think. So, like, you know, again, even as, you know, there, you read stories in this collection that are like, eh, you know, that one didn't work for me. Or like things like The Moving Finger, which also is like similarly the iconic story from this, I think. But like you actually read the story and you're like, oh, there's a bunch of stuff in here that is it's complicating what I thought was a very simple, effective story. It's still informing. It's still, these are still all glimpses into a worldview that that feels so real and feels so believable. And it's just a glorious, you know, sequence of magic tricks of like, oh my god, like I'm gonna believe this bullshit for a little while. Isn't that a gift? Isn't it a gift to have a collection of stories, some which work for you, some which don't, but each one you're like, never experienced that before.
Yep. Take me for a ride.
Yeah. I do believe in spooks. I do believe in spooks. I can hear him saying these words because of that tape.
Great. Well, you know, I think that that's a good spot to end it, so we don't end up, you know, going like Gone with the Wind length on this episode. So, Nat, do you want to do one final reminder to the audience where they can pre-order your latest work, or if you want to sell them on something that's out, this is your time, baby. You do whatever you want.
I'm all about the pre-orders. Yeah, you can pre-order I Know a Place, Rest Stop and Other Dark Detours, which comes out May 5th. It's available wherever books are sold. When is this episode dropping?
Probably in 2 weeks.
2 weeks? Perfect. So I can say there will also be a, for the people who like Barnes & Noble special editions, there's a special edition that has a couple of bonus stories in it and its own unique cover image if you like a special edition. Or you can get the trade edition. The audiobook is going to be awesome. There's a bunch of really fun audio-only kind of full cast dramatizations and
special
effects.
Did you get Tim Curry and Yardley Smith?
We got Tim Curry, we got Whoopi Goldberg, we got Rob Lowe. They are
Jerry
reading
Garcia,
stories.
Jerry Garcia, AI,
yeah,
but Jerry Garcia.
We got Jerry Garcia. Yeah. It is a moment of silence. yeah, so if you like your stories that way, it's going to be a really cool audio edition. And you can read the intro by Stephen King that I'm still absolutely flummoxed. He graciously gave to us. It is going to be a really fun collection. If you like a Stephen King collection, I think you will really like this collection. It goes to a bunch of eclectic places, and the mission statement really was finding that balance between the literary and the just unabashedly pulpy and genre-y, and, you know, finding a way to fit EC Comics horror stories next to more poetic ones. There's an epistolary story told in all emails. There's a story, if you like, you know, they got a hell of a band. Then there's a story all about the Beatles in this that I'm very, very proud of. I think... If I may say so myself, which I don't know if I can, but I will attempt to put humility aside and say, if you like a Stephen King collection, you're really going to like this collection as well.
I can vouch, and I'm not just blowing smoke, man.
Hey,
this is,
thanks.
You know, right. I was like, yeah, when I was reading through it, I was just like, okay, all right, you got me. This is you know, and I'm not very easy to please when it comes to this kind of stuff. I'm so heavily read on Stephen King, and it's really tough for most other authors to pull me in, and for you to be able to do that, you know,
no, go ahead.
No, sorry. No, it's all good.
I was going to
try
and
say, you can both compliment me, please.
Uncle Steve himself compared you to EC Comics and the Creepshow vibe. So there you go.
I will.
What better high five is there than that? So, 100%. You work hard, and I'm happy that all these good things are happening. I hope people pick up the collection. I got my arc in order to prepare for this, but I'm gonna pick up my copy and hope we get to cross paths in real life sometime. You'll have to sign.
Get that Barnes & Noble version that has the weird embossed glossy sun and moon on it. So no.
Yeah.
the alt cover to trick right. people into going, oh, a new Nat Cassidy book. No, but yeah, I will. I'm putting the call out to all the KingCast faithful. Listen to me, pre-order this book. You will not be sorry.
God bless you. Thank you. And especially because short story collections are a hard sell these days. So we want to prove them wrong.
Prove them wrong. Get them.
Yeah.
Get it. You'll love it. Well, thanks, Nat. This has been a pleasure. And as always, Brez, it's been an honor to chat Stephen King, to tag team Stephen smoke. King on this.
All right, guys. Catch you later.
Many thanks to the great Nat Cassidy for once again coming on the show to nerd out about Stephen King. I don't know about you guys, but Nat's quickly becoming one of my favorite returning guests. And speaking of, if everything goes to plan, the next episode of the KingCast you will hear will have another popular returning guest. I don't really want to say who it is in case things fall apart at the last minute. We haven't recorded it yet, but I will give you a hint. He's the star of one of the best Stephen King adaptations, and he has a new reason to come on the show and talk about King stuff. I think that's cryptic enough to not completely give it away, but you might be able to guess it if you do some research. So go try to figure that out. I'm excited about this returner, and I just want to be a little cryptic for one, funsies, and two, just in case everything falls apart. But as of right now, we got a date locked in to record. It's going to be fun. I'm very excited to chat with this person again. So keep an ear out for that. And in the meantime, make sure to rate and review the show on whatever podcatcher you listen to us on and sign up for our Patreon. Those are the best ways to directly support the show, especially Patreon. At patreon.com/thekingcast, you will find 5 years worth of bonus episodes and be the very first to hear any new bonus eps that come down the pipeline. That's patreon.com/thekingcast. Until next time, adios, folks. The KingCast is hosted by Eric Vespi, that's me, and Anthony Bresnikan. The show is produced by myself as well as Abby Goel and Tara Ansley, and is distributed by the Fangoria Podcast Network. Daniel Danger is our art director, and the show was created by me, the late, great Scott Wampler.